Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Danny.
Hello, Matt.
How are you, mate?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing all right, mate. I want to say thank you so much for doing this again. You're an absolute gent.
Don't worry, Pez. You had a nightmare with your laptop, didn't you?
A nightmare. Yeah, the less said about that, the better. We'll move swiftly on. Yeah. Life's good, though. I'm organising a Halloween party for Halloween weekend, and I'm going to have my first DJ gig in, God, like 8 months. So I'm excited about that.
Looking forward to that. Yeah, great stuff. Yeah.
It must have been amazing for you. I gather you very recently finished shooting series 2 of Code 4. So, I mean, it must have been, A, not only amazing to get back to doing what you love, but obviously working on a project like that with someone like Steve, it looks like you two have more fun than should be legally allowed on set making that. Is that the case?
Yeah, there's we got sent the outtakes reel that they compiled for series 2. I don't know if you ever got round to seeing the reel from the first series, but yeah, it's even funnier.
Where can you view that? Is that just on YouTube?
I think it is on YouTube. I think Sky, like, you know, officially sort of released it in the run up to the launch of the TV show. But yeah, no, it's great to get the opportunity to work with Steve Graham on Code 404 is an absolute joy, and all the other actors as well. We've got Anna Maxwell Martin in there and Richard Gadd. And
oh, you've got Steve Oram from Sightseers, who's just so dry.
Steve Oram's in there. Yeah, yeah. So,
and who's the lady that was in Vera Drake with you? Rosie, she's in Green Wing and Peep Show. And
Rosie Cavaliero, who plays Dennett, our boss.
She is amazing in the show.
Yeah, she just has us in absolute hysterics. And so I mean, the level of corpsing that goes on is next level. But it's great when you have that sort of buzz on set like that, and we are led brilliantly by our extraordinary director, Al Campbell, who has got an amazing track record in comedy. And it's just a great team. You know, we obviously went back to shooting in COVID times, but I think once we got over that sort of first week and we've all kind of got used to it, we adapted really well. And, you know, because lots of the actors and the crew hadn't sort of worked for 7 months, or I mean, I hadn't done any acting for 7 months, so I was a bit ring rusty. But once we got our groove on, we were just loving it. And I think we've produced a really even more ambitious and funnier and more engaging second series. So yeah, we're buzzing about it.
How would you describe that show to anybody who's not seen it? It's available it's available on Now TV. I've seen the whole of Series 1. I absolutely loved it. I think you two together just make such a great double act. Steven's kind of the straight guy, but he's still also very funny. But you in this are just hysterical, mate. How would you describe the premise?
We always described it as the love child of RoboCop and some mothers do have them.
That's amazing. That is the best like synopsis I think anybody could come up with.
Out of the park with that description, haven't we? I mean, it's just, he's the best cop in the unit. It's set in the near future and he gets gunned down at the beginning, but because his stats are so good, you know, he's got the best arrest record in the unit, that they decide to then bring him back from the dead. So he's part man, part AI, but the sort of wiring's all wrong. So it becomes a sort of comedy of errors with him kicking down the wrong doors and arresting the wrong people and just basically screwing the whole thing up. But in the time it's taken him a year to come back. But in that time, Stevens' character has sort of fallen head over heels in love with my wife in it, played by Anna Maxwell Martin.
Yep.
And so there's a kind of like love triangle thing going on. There's a conspiracy thriller that runs all the way through it. So, great. It is slapstick. It gets very silly.
It's very high budget as well, isn't it? Like the production value of it is very slick.
Yeah, it's Kudos is behind it and Water and Power Productions. And, you know, it kind of like starts like an episode of Line of Duty. You know, the production values in it are really high. And so, but like I was saying, when you get really great actors in it as well that are predominantly probably known more for their dramatic acting, with me, Stephen, and Anna particularly, it does bed it down in sort of a truth and a reality. But of course, then it goes completely off the wall into slapstick. So there's a blend of so much going on in there that it's just an absolute joy to perform.
Yeah, and it just looks like you have such a good time making it. Like, you can just tell sometimes when you're watching a film or a TV show or, you know, a stage production, whatever it is, you're like, it is clearly obvious that these actors are relishing every second of this. And that just makes it all the more enjoyable for the audience, doesn't it?
I think so. And I think particularly we relished it even more second time around. Because,
I bet, of course, yeah.
You know, you never know how these shows are going to land with an audience. But, you know, it was Sky's most successful comedy in 8 years. And sort of the buzz on social media and everything and the amount of people that watched it was phenomenal, really. So that gives us a confidence. We know the characters a lot more. And there was, you know, we were able to risk a little bit with it. We were sort of ad-libbing a lot more this time round, and that can only, I mean, what it is all about is just giving Al the director choices when he gets to the edit. Do you know what I mean? So I think much more this time around, we would sort of, let's do one really silly one, really straight one, and just to give the director choice at the end of the day. So, and like I said, there's bigger stunts in it. There's just more ambition behind it. And I think the fact that we've been able to achieve that during a sort of global pandemic is just testament to how hard and brilliant everyone is. Not how hard they are.
How hard working they are. The crew is nails.
It's great. It was just an absolute treat from start to finish, really.
Well, I don't want to linger on it too much, but I am interested to pick your brain just about the realities of what it's like on set now in this kind of, well, not even post-COVID world. We're in COVID. What's it like on set? Like, what difficulties do those restrictions present you as actors and then, you know, the crew as technicians and craftsmen?
Presently, I'm filming the second series of Temple, the show I shoot with Mark Strong.
Yeah.
And I was having a great discussion with James, our first AD. And I think really when it comes to prepping these shows, that's really where the difficulty lies. You know what I mean? It falls on the shoulders a lot more for the execs and the producers and the crew in leading in the pre-production. That takes kind of like, I think, twice as long. But hopefully when you get to actually filming it, I think in many respects it feels the same. The biggest difference is the fact that the whole crew are in masks and PPE and the actors have to wear masks to and from set. And I mean, for instance, with Temple, we've all got our own individual tents that we have to sort of stay in. So
right, like your own little bubbles on set, almost.
Yeah, yeah. So listen, there's a definite sort of different energy with it, but in terms of when it comes to playing the scenes and finding the reality of the scenes and doing your job, basically, that pretty much feels exactly the same, because that was my biggest concern. You know, when it gets to, if you're doing intimate scenes or fight scenes and things like that,
I'll bet,
the COVID restrictions going to hamper that? And I think the fact is that when everyone is being, you know, COVID tested twice a week, there's a sort of security in that, and you're able just to go onto set and do your thing. I think the biggest sacrifice, it has to be said, in terms of the actors, is away from the set. You know, when it comes down to what you're doing in your downtime, be it on a weekend. I mean, in no uncertain terms, you can't go to restaurants. You have to avoid track and trace, enclosed spaces, pretty much how lots of people are living their lives at the moment. So you just have to be doubly aware away from set in order to not jeopardize the production as a whole. So in terms of what the actors are sacrificing, and indeed the crew, it's a huge deal, really. So
yeah, nobody wants to be the person to shut down the production, do they?
No, I mean, you know, if I sat in a restaurant and I've given my details over, and I, you know, there's a complete stranger in the corner of this restaurant who gets COVID and I get contacted through track and trace, that person may be the reason why we have to shut down for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
I mean, you'd never forgive yourself. So it's trying, testing times. But in order to get these shows made, you have to go through that process. Because at the end of the day, you know, we're running out of content, and there are, I think somebody said to me, there's like literally like 10 productions shooting at the moment in London, which is not that many at all. So it's a huge effort for all concerned.
Yeah, I guess I hadn't really thought about it in that way, but there has to come a time, if, you know, production doesn't get ramped up, that we do get to a point where it's just reruns and there's nothing new being made.
Yeah,
which would be
you'll be watching reruns of Yeah, of all creatures, great and small, or darling buds of May forevermore. So it's a ginormous effort for everyone, really. But I feel blessed and thankful that, you know, that I'm actually back working, because there's a hell of a load of actors that aren't. And I'm just sort of blessed that both Code 404 and Temple have both been recommissioned and we're able to go back to work.
Well, gratitude and luck and good fortune is a big part of that. But if, you know, if I can say so objectively, looking at the history of your career, you've never really not worked. It seems like you've always consistently been either in films or in TV shows or on the stage. And it seems like there's a really rich variety of work over the years. And particularly recently, COVID aside, you've been on a hot streak, my friend. Haven't you?
Yeah, up until lockdown, I did have a ridiculous run of work.
Yeah. Let's talk about Dez. Huge success, 10 million views.
Yeah.
Talk to me about the part when you were offered it and you read the script. What was your reaction? Because it's an amazing role. It's obviously a very dark, compelling, just amazing drama. What was your reaction when you got sent that and were offered the part?
I literally got an email from my agent. I was on a night shoot filming White Lines out in Mallorca, and then it's just one of those dream emails that you open that says, you know, it's the star opposite David Tennant, it's a three-parter for ITV, and it's the story of Dennis Nilsson and your cast. You've been offered the role of DCI Peter J, the detective responsible for his conviction. So it was as soon as I read that on the email, I was like,
whoa.
I pretty much don't have to read the script. So I'm sort of already in. But I mean, it was a fantastic script from Luke Neal. I thought it was, you know, it wasn't gratuitous. There was no killing. We weren't sensationalizing Dennis Nilsson in any way.
Would you mind just giving us a very brief description of who he was? Because he's obviously a real life killer.
So, Dennis Nilsson was one of Britain's most notorious serial killers. He went on a killing spree in the late 80s from 1978. He was caught in 1983, and he killed lots of young homeless vagrants, some gay men. And he basically went on a killing spree for 4.5 years. He was at a property in Melrose Avenue and then moved to a property in Muswell Hill called Cranley Gardens and was eventually caught because he didn't have any outside space to dispose of the body. So he would dissect the bodies and flush the body parts down his lavatory, which obviously clogged up the drains. The Dino Rock guy found that out. And then obviously the police were called and Peter Jay, along with his constable, Steve McCusker, were summoned to Cranley Gardens and waited for him all day. And if you've seen the show, that the beginning of theirs is pretty much exactly how it happened.
Yeah.
They waited for him all day. He worked in Kentish Town in the job centre. And then they opened the door and they went up to his flat and the stench of death hit them immediately. And
he doesn't deny it for a second, does he? That's why it's so unsettling. Is he just is like, yeah, you got me.
No.
Bang to rights. What do you want to know then? Do you want to know why I did it?
Yeah.
He almost plays it out like a game of chess, doesn't he?
Well, I think, I mean, the script is heavily based upon Brian Masters' amazing book, Killing for Company.
Right.
Brian Masters is played by Jason Watkins in our show. But, I mean, I advise anyone to read that book. It's a phenomenal piece of writing. But when you read that, I mean, in many respects, Dennis Nielsen, in a way, sort of wanted to be caught. He was the guy that actually phoned up the landlord and complained about the drains, which seems absolutely bonkers, really. I mean, the whole thing is mind-boggling. It's unfathomable, like, what he actually did.
And why he did it, what was, like, the driving
force. And why he did it. And
force.
I think that's what's so great about the show is that it isn't, as I said, it's not gratuitous. It's a much more psychological investigation into why he did it and how he became who he was, you know what I mean? So it's, and it offered three amazing lead performances for me, Jason and David, you know, and I think,
all of you are just superb in it. So good.
Yeah. I mean, I'd worked with Jason years ago on a show called Funland and I had a cough and a spit in Good Omens along. I'd one scene with David Tennant and that, but you know, all that, you know, when you compare it to Dez, when we really got these fantastic scenes to play across from one another. And I mean, I hadn't watched it for a while and then I sat down with my son Milo, who's 14, and we actually sat down and watched it. And I was, you know, some of those scenes, the length of the scenes, the intricacy of the scenes, and to get to work opposite two actors like that was just unbelievable, really. And not just those two, it was the whole cast was filled with a wealth of brilliant acting talent in Ron Cook, Barry Wald, Jay Simpson. You know, we were blessed to work with some amazing actors. So, and the way it's been received and the audience figures for ITV, you know, it's a bona fide hit for them. And that's just, I'm so pleased for them, actually. Yeah, it's very gratifying.
How was it really kind of doing that dance with David Tennant? And was he kind of isolated on set when you weren't, you know, in the scene? Was he keeping himself to himself and trying to remain that kind of, you know, elusive figure to fit in with the role?
To a degree. I mean, I had, because I'd worked with some of the actors playing the police before, but we bonded, you know, we went on a long drinking session before we started filming. And that's
the job days.
When you're able to go to a pub with a group of people, we had a great night out. So all of the coppers, and I love the fact that when you watch this, that camaraderie really comes across with all of the police. So we had a lot of banter going on set, as you could probably imagine with tough subject matter like that. You need to keep a degree of levity with it.
I was going to ask, is that how you do that balancing act? Because you really just try, and the minute you stop rolling, let your hair down and have a laugh and break that tension.
Yeah, because, you know, when it had to be serious, it really was. I mean, when you take, for example, the interrogation scene in the first episode, you know, it was clear then when David steps on set, he's in his costume, he physically resembled him so well. But what he did more than anything I can remember was just the complete and utter embodiment of that role. You know, I've seen footage of the real Nielsen. There's so many documentaries you can watch and ITV gave us all those, and I just thought it was an absolute masterclass. I mean, I've been in scenes with actors before where you kind of, you know, they've shot on you first and you've delivered your performance and then you turn around and you're basically just giving off lines. And it happened to me once before with Ben Whishaw on stage when we were doing Mojo, where you feel yourself just...
He's so great as well. I love him.
Yeah, but they're so amazing and they're so in the moment. And David Tennant had that in that performance as well. And I can remember just giving him these lines thinking, oh, this is just an absolutely spellbinding, sort of eerie but utterly captivating performance. So, I mean, both Jason and David are absolute at the top of their game and masters of their craft. So it's just, you know, it's great to work with actors like that. It's great to act across from amazing performances like that because, you know, you are just naturally forced to raise your game. And I mean, it was a wonderful character, Peter Jay, and he was always described to me by our brilliant director Lewis Arnold as the heart and soul of the piece. You know, he is the person that very much is at the heart of finding the identities of the victim, of securing justice for those victims and their extended families. Do you know what I mean? It was all about getting closure for the families, and that's what Peter Jay went through in reality. And the fact that halfway through, because of how much it was costing and how difficult the case was and how emotionally draining it was, the fact that they had to sort of close it down after only six victims was, you know, it's heartbreaking for Peter and his team because it was a 6-month investigation. You know, it took a hell of a lot out of them. There was no counselling in the early 80s for police at that time. And when you consider the content of what they were dealing with, the subject matter, you know, and Peter described it as he'd never encountered evil like that before. He was an inexperienced policeman. He dealt with serious crime. He dealt with murder cases, but nothing could prepare him for what was waiting for them, really, when they went there to Cranley Gardens. And it's I had to somehow embody that in the performance. And what is great for me, because I you know, we've spoken about Code 404, we touched upon White Lines, and even Temple, to a certain degree, all those characters are quite sort of extrovert. You know, they're either comedic or they're having tantrums or they're, you know, they lose their temper. And so they're sort of big performances. With Peter Jay, it was really great to sort of flip all of that on its head and play this really sort of insular, deep feeling detective. Do you know what I mean? And I, in many respects, a lot of those emotions is just played across my face. And it was about being very nuanced and minimal with it, which is probably not what people associate with me so much. So it was great to play in a different area, totally, yeah.
Well, you did a fantastic job, and one of my favourite scenes in the whole three episodes is the scene with Chanel Creswell, who people will know from This Is England. I think one of the most underrated actresses in the country. And there's that scene with her, and she, you know, she wants the truth and she wants justice for, you know, the person that she loves, and she's in pain, and she kind of says to you, doesn't she, you know, you don't really care about us, about the victims. All you care about is that you're the people that caught him. And that's a heartbreaking scene. So good. And you're both just incredible, isn't it?
It's funny you mentioned that scene, Matt, because somebody asked me today what's my favourite scene in it. And I mean, I adored the scenes with Jason Watkins in the pub scenes I had with him. And of course, the interrogation scene with David. But I think, you know, it was the whole point of Des was to illustrate the human cost of Dennis Nilsson. And I think Chanel, more than any of the other actors in it, really epitomised that heartbreak and the actual terror that they must have gone through.
Absolutely.
And it's a lovely scene in the final episode where it's during the court case. And she does. She says she's an absolute phenomenal actor. And she absolutely nailed it when she turned around and said, all you care about that you're the guys that caught Dennis Nilsson. And after Peter had to say sorry. And I think in that one moment, you can feel the weight upon his shoulders and the cost of what this case has taken out of him. You know what I mean? Because, I mean, in reality, he left the police force 2 years after the Nilsson case and became a private investigator. But I think he definitely got sick of the bureaucracy of the Metropolitan Police. I think he probably thought that he could never top the Nilsson case. And it definitely left a sort of indelible mark on him. And I think hopefully by the end of the programme, you kind of, you can get that from him, really, from the performance.
as you say as well, in the 80s, not only was counselling not offered, but mental health wasn't even really recognised still at that point, was it? So it was just like you're expected to just process this, and that kind of British attitude of, you know, keep calm, carry on kind of thing, isn't it? And forget about the emotional damage and baggage that that leaves you with. As an actor, as a performer, as a creative, when you're getting into that subject matter, how do you come down from that and readjust to like, oh, I finished work now? Do you instantly switch out of it, or do you carry it with you for a bit? What's your process of like taking that robe off at the end of it, as it were?
It depends on what the role is. It depends on, you know, some performances and characters affect you more than others. I mean,
what's been the one that's affected you the most, Danny? Would you say that one?
I definitely had a couple of nightmares when I was doing the research for Des, because I was poring over the documentaries. I read Killing for Company. I went and met Peter's widow, Linda, and his son, Simon. And they did say, you know, like, Peter was really good at leaving his job, you know, in the office, but the Nielsen case certainly affected him. But I woke my wife up on two occasions because I thought I was locked in an attic with Dennis Nielsen. So, and it happened twice. So that was a bit weird. But it depends, like, you know, it's a really heavy subject matter. I think the ones that have really stayed with me, I think Ronnie Biggs was something that really stayed with me, Mrs. Biggs, that I did with Sheridan Smith, because lots of people think, well, he was such a happy-go-lucky, charming character, but that was it was such a tragic end to their marriage and their family life. That was a big one for me. I also played Colin Parry in a single drama called Mother's Day, which was obviously about the IRA bombing in Warrington, which took the life of Tim Parry, Colin and Wendy's son. That was, I think that one was probably the most kind of difficult to act in, because, I mean, Tim was exactly the same age as my son Milo. I think he was 12. I think I might be getting that wrong, but
you can't but let that kind of comparison slip into your mind, no matter how awful that thought is. I mean, it's just bound to happen, isn't it?
Definitely helped the fact that I was a father myself. I think it would have been a sort of different performance if I hadn't been a father, and so you can't help but let your mind wander to that sort of magic if question. How would I feel if that had happened to me, you know? And I think something like Mother's Day, you know, you meet Colin and Wendy and you kind of get their blessing as such. But you, as an actor, well, me personally, I was like, am I emotionally going to be able to get to that point of, you know, how difficult it was for them? And the thing was that the Tim Parry story is so heartbreaking that in a way I didn't have to reach for it at all. It was all there. It was, but it was definitely the most difficult thing I've ever shot. And I was blessed to work, obviously, again with Anna Maxwell Martin, who played my wife in it, Wendy. So, and it was brilliantly directed by Fergus O'Brien, who I'd shot another single drama, Against the Law, with. So again, that was quite a tough thing to film. So it all depends on, I think I'm much better though, Matt, now I'm 20 years down the line with things, where you can, you know, when I started out as a young actor, it was like life and death to me. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, you want to own it and live in it and inhabit it.
Yeah. And I think I've got better over the years. My wife would probably disagree with you, but with me, but I feel like I've got, I can see it much more as a job now. And I think, you know, when you have kids yourself and you get older and wiser, you know, they don't really care about a scene's been difficult to film or the costume wasn't right or whatever it is. You know, you're back to reality pretty quickly. At the end of the day, it is just a job, and albeit, you know, an important one, but it's not, you know, I didn't want to be one of those actors who's old and grey and they haven't got a family to show for it, or, do you know what I mean?
Just their dusty awards.
yeah. I don't think that's what life's about, is it? Do you know what I mean? I mean, awards on a mantelpiece are never going to keep you warm at night, are they, really? They're nice to look at, but it's not probably not what it's about.
Hey, if you don't mind, I'd love for you to share the story about how your co-star and your good pal, Stephen Graham, helped, you know, you seduce your wife.
Well, he wasn't that up close and personal. He didn't give me a to-do list.
You worked together many, many, many years ago, right, on a show which I've since watched since we last spoke, and what a cult classic. It's one of those shows that I never was aware of because I never had like MTV or Sky growing up, so I missed out on a bunch of shows like that. Written by Johnny Vaughan, called Top Buzzer, kind of like a sitcom about like a dope dealer, right?
Yeah, it was described as the world's first dope opera. So it was written by Johnny Vaughan and Ed Allen, Dave Allen's son, and it was this mad sort of sitcom for MTV, and it was Stephen Graham and James Lance. They were Sticky and Lee, and they were basically cannabis dealers, and I played Colton, the annoying neighbour that used to come round and ponce weed the whole time. But it became a cult classic. I mean, look, there's still stoners that come up to me now and quote lines from Top Buzzer. But my wife Lou was the makeup designer on it. I fancied her from the word go, but I was just too shy to ask her out. And then I got on like a house on fire with Steve, and I told Steve, and he was like, "What are you doing? Just ask her out." And I said, "I can't." And in the end, he was Ursula Black, and he asked her out for me, and then it all... So, 2.4 children and a dog later. It's all down to Stephen Graham, So
I love stories like that. That's beautiful.
Yeah.
He's just a great guy as well, isn't he? He's so warm and lovable and personable and generous and sincere, and he's not only a great actor, but he's a great man as well, isn't he?
Yeah, I think the reason why Stephen's characters leap off the screen is the natural humanity and warmth that Stephen has in himself, that always bleeds through into his performances. I mean, he's an absolute dynamo on set. You know, he's got this ferocious energy.
Yep.
And he's able to somehow harness that. But along with it, he has this huge heart as well. And I think, I mean, you know, when I think of his performance recently in Shane Meadows' The Virtues, it just, I mean, for me personally, I thought that was Stephen's best work to date, and when you look at his track record and the performances that he's given in the past, that is saying something.
Yeah,
and I just think, you know, he's got for this industry, it's all about longevity, and it's all about how far you can take it. And I think, in a way, when I look at Stephen, I think the best is still yet to come. Do you know what I mean? And I think you've only sort of seen the tip of the iceberg with him. I mean, that's always the mystique and the beauty of the acting profession, is it you can go deeper with it, and it can resonate a lot deeper. And, you know, hopefully I can say the same about me, that there's parts I haven't played, and it's about trying to sniff those out and growing as an actor as you get older.
Well, your list is amazing. There's like big budget movies, low budget movies, Hollywood movies, British movies, film, TV. I'd like to touch on some of the stuff over the years in a bit, but I would like to get into White Lines a bit more, because I watched the whole of series one, well, the only series now, right? But I watched the season last week, and I loved it. I thought it was like, obviously, you know, a kind of very far-fetched premise, but then, you know, it's entertainment, so why shouldn't it be? And I just adore Laura Haddock. I think she is so...
Oh, yeah.
She's like old school movie star quality. There's just something about her. She's so watchable and likable and engaging as a performer. And your role in it as Marcus, he's just the most lovable, hilarious, like half-wit. He's so great.
Yeah.
And what a fun experience, first of all, it must have been just shooting that out in sunny Spain. But it's, I mean, my favorite scene in the whole thing is the scene where you and Laura, you're in a car and you've got a boat tied to the back of it with dead bodies in the boat, and you're driving through this tiny alleyway, and it's like a religious procession is coming towards you, and these kids are like jumping on the boat and they're trying to ride it, and you're obviously like, fuck, the bodies are in there. So you run out to try and stop them playing, and then the boat comes off like the hinge, snaps your leg, which is already broken, and you're just screaming on the floor with these nuns like, it was so funny and tense, and just, you know, a lot of, was that one of your favorite scenes to shoot in the whole thing, that one?
Yeah, I mean, it was it's funny you mentioned that scene. She gives me the last rites, doesn't she, or something, the nun.
Yeah.
And then I tell her, I'll go do one. That was an ad lib. That was just, that just happened in the moment, which they kept in, which was very funny. But look, you mentioned Laura Haddock. I just do want to big her up, because Laura, she I mean, on all of these productions, it always starts at the very top. You know, she was our lead in it. And I have to say, she didn't have an off day. I've never, ever seen someone work so hard as Laura Haddock on White Lines, because sometimes there was like three units filming at once. It was a gigantuan effort, that whole shoot. You know, we were filming in Madrid, in Mallorca. We had a stint in Ibiza. And sometimes she was jumping from three units. And she never, ever had an off day. She was always prepared. She always knew her line. She always had an amazing energy and grace about her. And I have nothing but the utmost respect and admiration for Laura. I think she's a stellar actor. And,
yeah, she's amazing.
Just delivered the goods. But as you can imagine, the whole shoot was... I mean, I've gone on record and said, without a shadow of a doubt, I mean, I loved playing Jim Keats in Ashes to Ashes, but my most enjoyable role to date was Marcus White.
It's got
to
be, right? The Hawaiian shirts, like, just smoking dope, just, like, the lovable loser driving around in, like, a tiny little child's Jeep car.
Everything about it was just hilarious. The clothes were hilarious. That sort of, the car, the sort of car he was driving, the fact that his leg was broken, he's got these Romanian drug dealers after him, his marriage is going down the tube, but he still thinks he's the man. And
I think
everyone knows someone like the Marcus who basically can't stop partying and still thinks he's 21. Yeah. You know, it's great. And I mean, I read White Lines, I could just sort of visualize it. But Left Bank, the production company, and Netflix, they just did an amazing job. And I mean, I don't think I've been in a show which has been loved so much by the audience. And the fact that, you know, sadly, it looks like we're never going to be doing a second series. I mean, the fallout from it's been huge because, I mean, for me, that show has an amazing fan base. And it was well received then.
People did love it because I was watching it because I'd sort of read somewhere that, you know, the response had been negative, so it wasn't recommissioned. So I watched it and I was like, this is an amazing show. What's not to like about this?
No, I don't think it's been recommissioned for those reasons at all. Because, right. I mean, you know, I have to look at it and say it was number one for over a month on the UK top 10.
Yeah.
It was number one all across Europe. It was number one. It was the most... I mean, listen, man, it was the number one show streamed on IMDb. I mean, we must have been doing something right. And I think, you know, everything about it I loved. I loved the writing. I loved how ambitious it was. I loved the fact that there was English actors, there was Spanish actors, Portuguese, this eclectic mix of all these nationalities. The locations were to die for. You had two time frames running parallel. So you had all these amazing younger actors. Tom Rhys Harris, Kel Spellman played me, you know, as a 21-year-old. And I think the way that they jumped between those two time frames was sensational.
I think what they also did really well, Danny, was the mix of quite heavy, dark, tragic material and then very lighthearted, funny stuff. But then also like really exploring friendship dynamics and how people evolve and grow or don't over time and what pressures that puts on groups of friends as they go from kind of adolescence to adulthood. I thought it juggled all of those tones really well as well.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I defy anyone to watch the last episode of White Lines and not say that was one of the, you know, best bits of television they've seen for a long time. And, you know, I would have loved to have played that character. I'd have loved to have gone on and played him in a second series, but alas,
you'd have been moving the family out to Spain if you could, right?
Yeah, I just had visions of him going to Bolivia and becoming this drug lord. I had visions of him being like...
Oh, the character arc with him could have been amazing, couldn't it? You could have gone in so many amazing directions.
He just makes the wrong judgments. He makes terrible decisions over and over, and I think...
And you continually love him for it, don't you, as a viewer? You just can't help but love him.
I mean, Matt, as soon as I read the first episode and you got to the bit with the pristine lawn and the big giant banana and the line of cocaine and the dogs, and I was just like,
sign me up.
Who the hell's who's written this? And you find out it's Alex Pina and he's done Money Heist, and you just go, I'm in. I'm totally in. It's just hilarious.
I loved it. I can't recommend it enough to anybody listening to this as well. And I'm a DJ, so I can kind of understand that world a bit as well and the characters that inhabit it.
I mean, I love the soundtrack in it. I mean, they released the album. The soundtrack is brilliant in itself. I got to film in like Fabric nightclub just outside Madrid, which was like the biggest nightclub I've ever been in.
Amazing.
And I love the energy of it. I love how sort of vivacious and in your face that whole show is. And I think, you know, it obviously landed in lockdown and it was everybody's sort of summer Ibiza fix. I mean, it just sort of hit exactly the right time.
And, you know, from my point of view as well, all my dad's side of the family are all from Manchester. So there's just so many recognizable personality traits in a lot of those characters as well. It felt like, you know, I know these people. I know this world. Just put a big smile on my face, man. I loved it. You know, maybe it will get revisited when the COVID dies down. I'd love to go to Line of Duty. I know you're only in one episode, but what an episode that is. What a character that is. What a storyline. What you do in such a short space of time from a writing standpoint, from a performance standpoint. Again, I wonder if you wouldn't mind just kind of describing to me how that offer was presented, your initial reaction, and then we'll talk about getting stuck into it with Vicky McClure and the rest of those amazing actors on that show.
It was just I used to be flatmates with Craig Parkinson, who plays the caddy in it. And
When you were like at drama school, or
I splat with a girlfriend, as did Craig, and then we did a reading together, and we just instantly hit it off. And then he was looking for a flat, as was I, and then we had a mental flat sharing for a year.
Freshly single, young upcoming actors.
It was like I remember us having a flat warming, and it pretty much got gate crashed by the entire people in Crouch End. It was like the Yellow Pages advert with the
go on in the who carpet was there and all who that. Was there
James Corden was there, and Dominic Cooper was there, and I know they were probably two of the biggest names. Anyway, it was many years ago,
and they were living together as well, right?
I think they were living together, James and Dominic. So it was a mad party. But
he seems like a really good guy, Craig does. Another one who, he's so warm and affable in life, and as you were saying with Stephen, that humanity and that humour and that pathos and all of that sensitivity and warmth within him shines in all his roles, doesn't it?
And if you haven't heard, he's amazing. Podcast. He does the Two Shot podcast.
I love it. I want to get him on mine. I absolutely love it. I think it's one of the best podcasts in the UK.
So, I mean, he started out with actors, but he does musicians and poets and loads of different people now. So, I mean, I wholeheartedly recommend anyone, if they haven't listened to it, to do so, because it's brilliant. And I did an episode of it a few years back now. But so I'd watched Craig in the first two series and was a massive fan, and you obviously look at it and think it's Lenny James and Killy Hawes as the lead actors in it. And then you get the audition that comes in saying you've got a meeting for the new protagonist for the third series, and you're like, wow, that sounds amazing. And they send the script through, and then you sit down and you read it, and you get into that 10-page interrogation scene written by the masterful Jed Mercurio. And you're like, and you're just reading speech after speech, like, because the character's this like robot. He's got this sort of really hard veneer of this armed response police officer. And you think, what an amazing piece of writing. And then you get to the end of it, and then you have that, the rug is pulled from beneath you, and you're like, hold on a minute, what's happened here? And so I had to go in and audition, and that's the first thing that came out of my mouth, was just like, so what's going on? Does he survive?
And they went, is there flashbacks? No.
Yeah. And they go, unfortunately not, Danny. This is what we're going to do. We're going to announce the new lead actor, and then we're going to kill him off at the beginning of the second episode. And I was just like, wow. Okay. So I had to audition for it. And I remember reading some pages from that interrogation scene.
Can I ask you a question, Danny? Did you consider turning it down because it was, you know, because of the brevity of the role?
No, not at all. No. I mean, I as soon as I read it, it was one of those that I just thought, this is, I just recognized it as an amazing opportunity and a fantastic part, you know,
And it is such a rich, layered part, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, listen, it was a definite game changer for me. I mean, I'm talking probably about 5 years ago we did it. I mean, I got BAFTA nominated. It seemed to put, you know, raise me up a notch, and the roles that have come in after Line of Duty have been fantastic, you know. But it was, for an hour's television, you know, where it took me as an actor, it was, and what I had to do with the audience was phenomenal. You know, you were absolutely repulsed by this guy. He guns down this, you know, criminal at the very beginning, and it's totally edge of your seat opening to that episode, that series. You know, it was, what on earth's going on here? And yet by the end of that, you're kind of, you feel this degree of sympathy for him because you realize that this guy has been sexually abused. He's carrying around this torment and this abuse. And somehow I managed to sort of portray that in an hour's piece of television and get a BAFTA nomination for it, which was amazing, you know. So, to date, it's one of the most memorable days filming. The interrogation scene was the penultimate day's filming for me. It was the second to last day, and it was just amazing to sit across from Vicky McClure, Adrian Dunbar and Martin, and just to film that scene. It was great. And we all went out in Belfast, and we went to the merchant, we had tapas. We went to the merchant, and Adrian Dunbar said, "I'm going to buy you a really expensive bottle of red wine, and we're going to drink it together. Because you deserve it, Danny." And I had such an amazing experience with all of those guys. And
they look like they have a lot of fun on set. They're always sharing things on their personal, you know, just Instagram, social media pages. And you always just kind of see, wow, these guys are genuinely friends and they're loving every day at work. And they're just, you know, not only producing great work, but they're enjoying each other's company and just having the best time doing it.
Well, I think so. I mean, you know, mine comes from Ken Loach, and Vicky is Shane Meadows, and Adrian's done so much work. So they're just, I think they have within themselves, those three actors, and lots of other people in it. You know, they're very good in social realism. They have a sort of amazing realness and truthfulness to their acting. And I think the fact that you've got that style of acting within that writing in that thriller type show that keeps you on the edge of your seat, it's just a winning formula. And anything that, you know, the fact that it's police investigating police, for me, is absolute gold. And the fact that it's written by Jeb Mercurio, who is so intelligent, has a complete understanding of the mechanics of the police force, and he's, you know, got advisors around him, that the dialogue is second to none, the level of detail in it is second to none. You know, when I think about all of those passages of dialogue I had to learn, of how a bullet flies through an air and how a gun works, and I mean, all of that comes from Jed. So it's an absolute gift, really, when you get to speak it. And what I love about Series 3 was that it seemed to just, the floodgates seemed to open for that show after that series, and it's become this sort of juggernaut now, and it's on BBC One, and it's BBC One's, you know, one of their top rating shows. So I'm just happy for Jed and those actors and World Productions and Simon Heath and all those people that make it. I'm just over the moon for them, yeah.
And they did a similar thing, spoiler alert, with Stephen Graham's character, didn't they? And I love the bravery of those choices and the feeling of excitement and, you know, just to be able to take a chance like that and know that the payoff's going to work because it's going to be memorable and brilliant and different. And I think that, you know, not many projects do that, do they?
No, I think that's the beauty of Jeb Mercurio as well, is that he's not afraid to pull the rug. And I think they're on their sixth or seventh series now, and I think the audience love that about it, and they're sort of waiting to see what happens next. Yeah, we had Line of Duty death comparisons on the set of Code 404. Yeah, but again, you know, the beauty of Line of Duty is they are able to, because the writing is so good, they're able to entice these really fantastic actors like Stephen. You've got the equally brilliant Kelly MacDonald in it now. You had Tandy Newton, you know, so the caliber of actors they're able to attract is second to none. And I think, I mean, I don't know if the next series they do will be the last one. That's what I keep hearing. But if it is, then I imagine that they could bring, you know, a phenomenal heavyweight actor in to bring it to a close. But I feel so lucky that I'm in that ensemble of actors, particularly the people that have played the protagonist, you know. And it was brilliantly started by Lenny James, who I just love Lenny's work. I love Save Me, which he's gone on to do, and he's written that himself. I think he's such a phenomenal actor to watch. And then you had Keely Hawes following him, and for me, what Keely did in Line of Duty was her best work to date. I think it was, there was no vanity in it. So it just offers amazing opportunities for whoever is in it. So I hope it goes from strength to strength.
Do you think as well that was the one, because you've been consistently working for the last 20 years, really, but it seems to have been in the wake of that show and that particular role that you've kind of moved from the supporting actor to the leading role in a lot of these great TV series that you've been in and some of the more recent films like Fisherman's Friends. Was that the game-changing moment, do you think, then?
Possibly. I mean, I always say to young actors starting out, you know, no role is ever too small enough. You can, you know, a case in point is Line of Duty. It's one episode, but you're able to make an impact. I mean, I remember when I went into the Line of Duty audition, I'd done a show called Public Enemies, which was written by the brilliant Tony Marchant that was opposite Anna Frill. That was a massive sort of role for me as well. And I do remember, because Jed and Tony are firm friends, and I remember the first thing that Jed said. He said, by the way, before we start, I just want to say I watched Public Enemies, and I thought you were phenomenal in it. And you go, great, you've got a kind of, do you know what I mean? You've got like a, you feel a bit bolstered by that, and you think, right, let's deliver, go ahead and deliver the audition. So I think it's all about longevity. It's about consistently delivering in each performance that you're fortunate enough to get. And I think work then, for me, work breeds work, whether that be a director wanting to continue the working relationship or the producer that you got on with. Do you know what I mean? It's about having a great relationship with your agent and them wanting to push you in different directions. And I think the longer you stay in the game, hopefully the different opportunities will come your way. I mean, my dear old acting teacher, Dee Cannon, who just passed away, sadly, from RADA.
I saw you post a very, you know, lovely, heartfelt tribute to on your Instagram page.
Yeah, and I mean, I'd been so busy, and it's not that we'd lost contact, but I hadn't spoke to her for a while, and she always came to all the plays and supported me. And she was really the person that opened up my whole mind to the brilliance of acting, of how it can enrich your life and how you can internalize a character and use the Stanislavski technique and emotional recall and the magic if. And so she was really my blueprint. She was the one that really sparked my imagination with it all. And she sadly passed away from cancer, and I never got the chance to say, getting emotional now, but to say sort of thank you to her, really. So It's sort of bittersweet that I just didn't get a chance to say goodbye to her. But I've sort of lost my train of thought now. But she meant the absolute world to me. And every performance I've gone on to deliver is all because of her teaching.
It's people like that, really, that I think are the absolute like life source of the creative industries. The people that put their arm around you when you're young and inexperienced and developing and hungry and kind of shape you and direct you and give you those tools, as you say, and instill that excitement and that thirst to grow in you. And they're often the people, obviously, because they're not in the public domain, that kind of go unsung. But they're the people, aren't they, that really, you know, drive, whether it's a musician, a songwriter, an actor, whatever it is, these teachers and these mentors.
She totally put her arm around me, and I gravitated towards her because, you know, I'd come from stage school. I'd come from Italia Conti, which was brilliant, but it was tits and teeth. Do you know what I mean? It was from the outside in. And, you know, lots of my fellow students had all been to university. They were all brilliantly educated, and they could all talk to the cows come home about the process of acting. A bit of that. I mean, they were all great, but I got very intimidated when I first went to RADA because it was so different. And I was always aware that I was walking through the front doors of RADA every single day. And, you know, I was shying away from Shakespeare classes, and I wasn't being myself, and I didn't have any confidence. And it was only when I walked into these acting classes three times a week that it just sort of, all of a sudden, she ignited something in me. And I was able to then get rid of all those inhibitions and just go into the space and do it, because ultimately that's what it's all about. You can philosophize and talk a good game, but it's about what you do when they shout action or the curtain goes up. It's how truthful you are, how believable you are in the moment. And it was the teachings of Dee Cannon and everything she gave me that I hold on to this day.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
And it must be really exciting for you, because it sounds like you come from a very similar school and approach, when you get to work with the likes of Vicky McClaw, Stephen Graham, Chanel Creswell, obviously Thomas Turgoos and Swimming with Men as well. All these people that kind of come from that, as you mentioned earlier, like social realist approach, that it's just so naturalistic, isn't it? And it's almost like second nature. Like, it's not forced, it's not contrived, it's not staged in any real way. It's about pure emotional truth.
No, but I always think, you know, actors say to me, oh, do you advise going to drama school? Or, and I always do. I think drama school is an amazing opportunity to give you a box of tricks when you leave. It will give you technique. It'll introduce you to playwrights. It'll, you know, you'll do voice work, physicality, all that stuff. But the actors you've just mentioned, and even actors that got, you know, are fortunate enough to go to drama school, you have an innate talent. You have this fire which burns in you. You can either act or you can't. Do you know what I mean? It's whether you're believable or not.
Yeah.
And it's about harnessing that talent, using the techniques to unleash that talent. That's what drama school does. But the actors that you mentioned there, I mean, a lot of them have been in This Is England and that. They have a raw, that they're raw. You know what I mean? You should always hold on to that rawness, that thing that made you want to be an actor in the first place, because that's all you've got. It's always about the fire that burns inside, and you have to protect that and you have to nurture that. And that's the thing that motors you along in this industry. And it's your own private thing, you know, and it's about when they say action and what it is you bring to the table. So it's a personal thing. And it should, you know, if you're thinking about being an actor, you've got to be 110% sure that that's what you want to do, because it's not for the faint-hearted. It's overly populated. It's competitive. And it's not a walk in the park. You know, it has to be life or death. And I don't want to sound dramatic when I say that.
No, I believe you. I mean, even just the process of auditioning and the knockbacks that you must get time after time after time, unless you're a real lifer, as you say, and it's in you and you need to express yourself, and it's almost like a calling, again, without being overly dramatic. You know, it has to, I think, be a lifelong pursuit, and you have to do it for the pure love of the craft, right? Because it's just too hard. The reality of it is too hard for the faint-hearted. They're not going to last.
I think you have to get used to rejection. You have to get used to the word no, that it hasn't gone your way. It hasn't worked out.
You just weren't quite right for this part. Yeah.
Yeah. You get used to those phrases over and over again. But it's about how you should be angry if you don't get something. It should piss you off. But it should.
And you channel that, right?
Fire.
You channel that energy.
You channel it and say, right, okay, that one hasn't gone my way. But next time I'm in a room with that person, they're not going to say no. They're not going to say no's not a choice for them. So it's about how you fuel that disappointment and how you use it. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
It's not rocket science acting. Sometimes I think, you know, kids can act. You get these brilliant child actors. I mean, I watched the other day that amazing audition tape from the kid that was in E.T. What was that? What's that actor's name? Elliot. Oh, no, the character's name is Elliot.
Yeah, he was in something recently as an adult, and he was brilliant in that.
Right. I mean, if you go and watch on YouTube his audition tape, and it's
for E.T., is it?
Goodbye. Yeah, yeah. He's saying goodbye. It's the end of the movie, and it's the most amazing audition because, I mean, he's just utterly in that moment saying goodbye to him, and he's in floods of tears. And the amazing thing is you get Steven Spielberg saying, kid, at the end of it, you got the part. It's just amazing. So it's about, you know, it's not rocket science, but it's about having the staying power and putting the work in, you know, and it's always about wiping the slate clean with every new character that you play and coming at it afresh. And ticking all the boxes, do you know what I mean? It's always about how much work you put in. I mean, that's my philosophy. I say to my son Milo and my kids, I say, you know, you're only going to get out of life what you put into it. And that you can apply that to anything, you know? So that's how I go about things.
I hear you, mate. I actually just posted, I don't usually post those kind of like inspirational quotes because I find them a bit corny.
Yeah.
But I've just been seeing a lot of negativity and kind of criticism and judgment and a lot of people just on the internet kind of venting their frustrations. And I understand currently with the way we're, you know, in this situation, a lot of people feel betrayed, let down, and they're kind of venting. But I was, you know, thinking about that quote from Gandhi, which is be the change in the world that you want to see. Like, it starts with you.
Yeah.
And if you're only putting out negativity and you're just moaning and, you know, you're just sending out bad vibes into the world, it's not going to create or contribute anything positive or good, is it? So why don't you just concentrate on you and the people you care about, start there, and let's try and change the world, like, for the better for everybody.
Yeah, because I get it. I mean, it is tough at the moment, you know, and I had a real thing in lockdown when we were about to go back to shoot Code 404, and I had a phone call from Stephen Graham, and he said, how are you feeling about this? Because I feel a little bit, I said, I know what you're going to say. It's like how, it felt like our first job. We were a bit ring rusty, but I had this deeper thing of like thinking how relevant is it what I do for a living? Do you know what I mean? I'm just an actor. I pretend to be other people and I'm jumping around and doing all that. But it's like having come off the back of frontline workers and the NHS doing this amazing, you know, all of the sacrifices that they've made. And I thought, how relevant is it? I mean, what is it? Is it important? What am I doing? Does it mean anything anymore? And it is. I mean, an actor is, their job is to entertain and to offer this form of escapism. And I think right now with what we're all experiencing, people do need a release. They do need, that's why I'm desperate to get the theatres up and running again, because when all of these restrictions are in place and sort of life itself is taken away from us and we're getting this feeling of separation and abandonment, it's a terrible thing for our mental health. But it's great that these shows that I'm in, they're on the TV, and hopefully they serve their purpose, really.
Well, that's so where people turn, isn't it, in these times, is they turn to comedy and television and cinema and music,
yeah,
and literature and podcasts. And these are the, you know, the arts, they're everything. It's like Churchill said, right? He did a lot of bad, dumb stuff. But one thing that he was always great about was if we're not protecting the arts, then what's the point? Do you know what I mean? Like, that is the very essence,
yeah,
of humanity, is these things that enrich our lives. And I know what you're saying, yeah, you might kind of doubt yourself sometimes and think, well, I'm not saving lives, I'm not changing the world, but actually what I am doing is putting something positive and good into the world and actually having, you know, these subtle waves of impact in people's lives that are putting a smile on their face, that are making them cry, that are moving them, that are inspiring them. And that's real and that's important, I think.
Yeah, and it's actually right what you say, Matt. Everyone can just do their bit. And I think, you know, we can all kind of muddle on through and, you know, be responsible for ourselves. And hopefully we'll come through this fucking horrendous pandemic, which we're experiencing. But yeah, you're absolutely right.
You mentioned Spielberg a moment ago, mate. How was working
that
on
that little name drop
segueing into Tintin, which at that time I guess would have been right at the forefront of that technology. Tell me, yeah, about just being on set making Tintin with Spielberg. How about that?
It was a complete sort of pinch me moment, and yeah, you mentioned it was motion capture, which I hadn't done before. And it was, listen, I had to try and style it out on set, but, you know, there's a little person inside you going, oh my God, there's Steven Spielberg directing you.
Yeah.
But he was amazing. He was just this sort of bundle of energy, and he had this sort of, I don't know, he had this ethereal, magical quality around him, and the way he would just ingeniously come up with ideas in the moment and just have fun with it. It was just incredible. And I shot it out in LA, and there was, you know, Daniel Craig was in it, and Simon Pegg and Nick Frost and all these amazing actors. So it was just an absolute joy, really, from start to finish.
And Andy Serkis, like, leading the field, right? Because he was obviously the guy that was, you know, the most associated with that whole development in technology because of Lord of the Rings and King Kong, and he's the guy, isn't he? What was it like, kind of, were you all learning from him to some extent, like how to apply what you know about your craft in this new context?
Oh, totally. I mean, like, Andy's like the motion capture guru, isn't he, off the back of Gollum and all the stuff he's done on Lord of the Rings. And I mean, it was, you know, the technology involved, it was just sort of completely alien to me, because, I mean, first and foremost, you had to sit in a makeup chair and have 200 reflective dots painted onto your face. Then your body is ROM'd through a computer, and you have like an all-in-one wetsuit on with these white reflective balls all around your body. And then you have a sort of helmet with an arm coming around with a camera, which photographs and films your facial expressions. So it's
kind of hard to look cool.
You can't look cool in that stuff whatsoever. But and then they animate over the performance. So you would go to Andy, and he said, "Listen, I mean, in essence, it's like doing a piece of theatre. And the more expressive you are of your face, and the more expressive you are within your physicality, the better for them. You know, it works for them. You know what I mean? They can sort of manipulate the performance." So it was really, it was quite freeing in a way. You didn't have to worry about camera angles or anything, because the whole thing was being picked up 360 degrees. But yeah, you're right. You can't style it out when you're wearing that. And the thing about the tinting experience was, because it was so sort of advanced in the technology, and because it was Peter Jackson and Steven Spielberg, lots of A-list actors were coming down. And so my stuff was with Mackenzie Crook.
I love him.
And we were like a double act together. And yeah. I remember standing there one day, and he's like, and so you'd be like, he'd nudge me one day, and he was like, look who it is. And you'd look up, and there was Tom Cruise standing there just at the monitors. And he's like, let's go and talk to him. And I'm like, no, we look like overgrown sperm, Mackenzie. I'm not going out and talk to Tom Cruise like this. And then Clint Eastwood come down, and it was just amazing, the amount of people that visited the set. But it was, I love Tintin as a movie. I think it's a real kind of work of art, and I think they did an amazing job on it.
I think we're almost at the end of our time, Danny, because I know you've got another interview after me. I wanted to ask you very quickly about Star Wars, if you wouldn't mind. I know it's kind of just like a, you know, a blink and you'll miss it kind of cameo part, but were you a kid that grew up with that cinematic franchise, like as a heavy part of your life? Was that, you know, a movie series that inspired you and lit you up as a kid?
Yeah, I was definitely into Star Wars much more than Star Trek. I wasn't a Trekkie by any stretch. And then when the new episodes came out, the new J.J. Abraham episodes, Milo, my son, he was really getting into it. And so what we did, we, in preparation for The Force Awakens, before that was released, we watched in chronological order all of the 6 episodes up until that point.
That must have been a nice journey to go on with your son as well. What a cool moment.
Oh, it was just cool. And then you sort of, you know, naturally, you're a kid again, you know, when the sort of graphic comes up at the beginning. When we sat down to watch The Force Awakens, I was really into it. And then this offer came in for the reshoots on Rogue One. And it was kind of like another sort of pinch me moment. And they said, you've been offered this role. Do you want to do it? We'll send you the scene. And it was like a proper 3-page scene with all this exposition in it. And I was like, it's an amazing opportunity. Yeah, of course I want to do that. And I remember, you know, the director, Tony Gilroy, saying, you cannot tell anyone about this. And I was like, oh, yeah, well, I take that, you know, as Red, he went, no, you cannot tell anyone that you're doing this film. So I was like, fine. And so I went back into the kitchen, and the first person I told was my son. And he said, and I said, don't tell anyone, Milo. And to be fair, he didn't. He was a really good boy.
That's a good trust exercise right there.
Yeah. And his jaw hit the, I think he was on the phone or he's playing a game. And I said, Daddy's going to be in the next Star Wars film. And his jaw hit the floor. And he went, you're kidding me. And I said, you're not allowed to tell any of your mates, all right? You can't. And this is a funny story. When Rogue One was released, he went to one of his mates' parties, and one of the dads had hired a miniature private screening for Rogue One. And so Milo's sitting there with all of his mates, and he hadn't told them I was in it. And all of a sudden, his dad pops up, and they're like, "Oh my god, Milo, it's your dad! It's Milo's daddy! Oh my god!" And then obviously, I get killed, and they went, "Ah." So it was just a funny moment for Milo. But I love Rogue One. I thought it was, for those spin-off films, I think it's the best one. It's proper dark. It really works.
Yeah, they really reinvented it, didn't they? They got rid of the opening title sequence and all those kind of like iconic things about the original series, which obviously everybody loved. So that in itself was a brave move. And I think you need to reinvent, don't you? Like the Batman franchise did that great, those Christopher Nolan films. I think sometimes if you're going to update it into the modern era, you need to take a new approach. And they did that really well.
I remember Tony Gilroy, the director, saying, because I said, oh, I'm getting killed off again. And he went, what do you mean? And I went, I get killed off everything. Like, you know, I'm either blown up, stabbed, shot, poisoned. And he went, hey, man, they can, you know, a prequel, baby, you can come back. And I was just like, yeah, all right. I figured that. And lo and behold, they're doing a TV spin-off with Diego Luna's character. And
amazing.
I'm like, where's the phone? Where's the phone call? You've got to bring Tivit back. But we're waiting by the phone, waiting for it to ring. But there you go.
Who's kind of one of your top? If you had to choose one, who's the top director you'd most like to work with? I know you've worked with some amazing and varied ones already. Michael Bay, Mike Lee, Steven Spielberg. Yeah. Who's the top of your wish list that you'd love to work with the most?
I think it's everyone that Stephen Graham's worked with. I'm constantly going, What was School Daisy like to work with? What's Shane Meadows? I mean, I'd love to do something with Shane Meadows. I think he is arguably the most imaginative and relevant filmmaker in Britain that's working at the moment. So, and I've loved his stuff. I love all the acting performances in it and how deep he gets into all of the characters. You know, I think it's, I'd love to do something with him. And, you know, I mean, the list is endless, isn't it? You think Michael Mann or, but definitely Scorsese, but we'll wait and see what happens.
That's it. Stephen, you know, you hooked me up with my wife. You've got to get on the case with Shane.
Yeah. I'm like, match make this throw one. Me a bone. Throw me a bone. I mean, there's a funny moment there. We've got this sort of weird computer, this robot thing in the second series of Code 404. And we were thinking, oh, what actor can we get to voice it? And, I was like, just phone Al Pacino. I mean, you're mates with him now, right? Just get him or Bobby De Niro. Can't you just make a call, Steve, and get it done?
Doesn't he do the best great Al Pacino impression as well? The ha!
yeah, he does all that. I mean, I love all of his anecdotes of being on set in The Irishman. They're just a sort of joy to listen to. And I have to say, it's not just because he's one of my best mates, but I mean, I thought Stephen was arguably the best thing in it. I wanted to see more of his character.
In The Irishman, 100%.
Yeah, the scene with him and...
him and Pacino, for me, were the top two, like, just most engaging performances in that film, for sure.
Yeah, when they're talking about being late to the meeting, I thought that was my favourite scene in it. And he just did a terrific job.
What's your favourite on-set anecdote to finish with, Danny? Have you got one that stands out?
Oh, you put me on the spot there. God, there must be...
Or if one doesn't spring to mind, who's just the most like eccentric, bizarre actor you've ever worked with? Like full method, cuckoo, genius, but just out there.
Well, I did listen to. This has just popped into my head. I did because David Morrissey does a podcast now, and he talks to actors about their most or one of the most memorable roles in their career. and he was talking to Eddie Marzan, who is an amazing actor, and they were talking about Vera Drake.
Yeah.
So that was the Mike Leigh film that I was in.
An amazing movie. That and All or Nothing, obviously those two early key films for you. Brilliant, brilliant films.
Yeah. And I've forgotten this hilarious story that happened. It's a bit rude, but I'll tell it anyway. There's the engagement party scene in that film.
Yeah.
And the Drake family had this sort of old fashioned table that extends out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those sort of, you know, like more, and it was like there lots of people around it.
It goes from a 4 to a 6 kind of thing.
Exactly like that. And when you're in a Mike Leigh improvisation, you never come out of the character till you're told to come out. And they can go on for hours and hours and hours. There was a long lot. There was a 15-hour improvisation on Vera Drake.
Wow.
When she got arrested, there was a whole area of the police station that we didn't know about. But I do remember in a very long improvisation, and Eddie retold this story on this podcast and said, and Imelda came out with, "Oh God, we're so excited. It's been years since I've got the flaps out." And we all just fell about laughing and got told to leave the room and things like that. So Eddie Marzan's one of the funniest, eccentric and brilliant actors to be on set with, as is the brilliant Imelda Staunton. I mean, we spoke about Des when it's tough subject matter. A lot of the time, I mean, that was about a Backstreet Abortionist. A lot of the time when it's tough subject matter like that, you kind of have the most laughs just to keep you going and have that levity. But yeah, I've been blessed to work with amazing actors over the years.
So many, mate. And just to end it on that note, that film is so difficult, but so important and so powerful to really understand what women had to go through for so long. You know, they're either being forced in high society to be made to feel just disgusting, almost for the pleasure of these perverted doctors, or your other option is you've got to go and, as you say, get this kind of homemade back alley abortion job. They're your options, and it really puts it into perspective, you know, like what women have had to endure, you know, historically in this country and all around the world. And I think to address that in such a way in that film it's just an incredible film, isn't it? And so well done.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the word genius is always thrown about, but I would definitely throw that at Mike Leigh, because he's a phenomenal filmmaker. And the thing I love about Mike, because he's a huge hero of mine, and I owe a huge debt of gratitude for the career that I've had, because I did back-to-back films with him very early on, is that he hasn't compromised. You know, even when Hollywood came knocking, he stuck to his guns, and he's a true artist because he wants to tell his own vision. And I think all power for him for doing that. But he just hit it out of the park with Vera Drake. It was a phenomenal success for him, with an amazing performance from Imelda Staunton. And I just feel blessed. I was, you know, as a young actor, to be part of that film was a real sort of highlight for me, yeah.
Yeah, must have set the tone for everything that followed as well, and got you off to a nice start,
I mean,
right?
Really,
if that's like
it,
your post-grad school is on set with him for two projects back-to-back, like,
yeah, I mean,
as good
I've
as it gets, isn't
about,
it?
Acting teachers at RADA, but to have back-to-back films with Mike, because his process is so unique to him, I think any actor that goes through that, it definitely makes you a better actor by the end of it, because he entrenches you in the truth of the character, and no stone is left unturned in the pursuit of the truthfulness and giving a fully fledged three-dimensional performance. You know, you absolutely saturate yourself in that world. And that particular film was, you know, early 1950s, Backstreet Abortionist and all the rest of it. And I mean, it was a strange film, because I had 6 months rehearsal, and for like 5.5 months of that, I had no idea that my mum in it was a Backstreet Abortionist.
Oh, wow.
So I do, all of that was because you only ever know what your character knows. So I was doing hours and hours and months of improvisation in this family with Phil Davis and Alex Kelly, who played my sister. And I thought, I've got no narrative. Like, I've got no, am I going to be cut out of this? And I do remember having this sort of wobble with him and saying, look, I mean, I haven't done anything of any significance, really, in terms of plot. And he went, don't worry, just keep going with it. And now I mentioned that 15-hour improvisation. That's when the pack of cards just crumbled and all of this secret came out. But it was to this day, it's the most amazing out of body acting experience I went through, that 15-hour thing. It was like being in a trance. Do you understand what I mean? It's like, for the entire time that she was taken away to this other police station, this other wing of this disused hospital, she was being interrogated for that entire hour after hour. We were still in character in the flat, constantly smoking Woodbines. And then eventually Phil Davis came back and sat us down and said she's been helping young girls out. And it was like a physical, like, I can only describe it as my stomach falling away.
And then you're not acting, are you? That is real. You're just reacting.
No, exactly. And then when you come to eventually film it in the final shooting schedule, you know, you have all of that memory and all of that experience to draw upon. I think that's why you get such sort of richness in the performances, particularly in Vera Drake. I think his particular method and the way he approaches things was brilliantly realised in that film. But you get it even in the period stuff. You think of Mr. Turner and Topsy Turvy and all that stuff. It's just a wonderful, amazing experience to go on.
Well, it's been an amazing 20 years, mate, and I want to thank you for sharing, you know, some of your stories and your time with me again.
dare I say it?
I think it was better. I think it was the better of the two. I was a bit nervous. I was like, shit, if we do it again and it's not as good as the first.
Yeah.
So I hope that you
whatever
agree.
You agree. Whatever you do, don't leave your laptop on the train, mate. Do me a favour.
I'm not even doing this again. I'm not even catching them again.
All right.
That's it. Danny, thank you so much, mate. All the best with everything.
Thank you,
man. And one day, me, you, Simon, and Grant from Feeder are going to go have a beer in London. And yeah.
Oh, I look forward to that.
Have a real life chat. Thank you so much, mate.
Cheers, Matt. All the best.
Cheers, Danny. See you in a bit, mate. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Cruel, cruel world, must I go on? Cruel, cruel world, I'm moving on. I've been living too fast, and I've been living too long. Cruel, cruel world, I'm gone.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.